Hi, Andy.
Hi, Victoria.
Today we will be speaking with Stefan Melick, who has created a very interesting toning device for the vagus nerve.
Well, the vagus nerve is much in the medical news these days. It's getting a lot of attention as a master regulatory of our physiology.
So let's get him on.
Okay.
Stefan Melick is a traditional Chinese medicine physician who is also trained in bodywork and trauma resolution. He has extensive personal experience with meditation and breathwork, and he's the inventor of Sensate, a vagus nerve toning device that uses sound and vibration to quiet the nervous system. Welcome, Stefan.
Victoria, thank you. Great pleasure and honor to be here.
So to begin, I just want to talk about the vagus nerve, which is the longest cranial nerve in the body. And the definition of vagus comes from Latin, which is wandering, and it literally wanders. It begins in our brain and it moves down through the neck and then into the body and to all or many of the organs of our body. Why is it so important?
It's a great question. You would think that it had been recently discovered by the amount of interest there has been for it. But of course, mammals have had a vagus nerve for 800 million years or so. So it's not really new per se. I think with the vagus nerve, what's happened is that a lot of the functions that we attributed to other structures are now being seen as being partly due to vagal nerve response. There are a number of internal senses, proprioception, interoception, cognoception, various types of nervous system responses, which are in addition to the five senses that we more classically know that we all have. The vagus nerve has a snappy name and a snappy title, so it's easy to kind of focus on and memorize. But of course, it is important to realize that it's part of the autonomic nervous system. So it's the largest nerve, indeed, in the body, but also in the autonomic nervous system. And it mediates the kind of internal and external worlds. So how we feel about things and how we process information from the brain, because as you say, it starts in the brain and it wanders all the way down into the pelvis, actually. You won't see that usually delineated in anatomy books, but I've dissected it out. It does go right down into the pelvis. So it does have sexual function and urogenitory problems as well. So there is a broad range of indications.
What I learned in medical school was that the vagus was the main conduit of the parasympathetic nervous system, whereas the sympathetic nervous system did not have a trunk conduit. It was a much more diffuse anatomical system.
Yeah, we have this fairly rigid definition of the autonomic nervous system, the central nervous system, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous systems. But as we're finding with the brain and the supposed idea of the two hemispheres, the brain, large parts of the body and large parts of the nervous system are involved in multiple things. We tend to talk about the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems in relationship to either flight, freeze, kind of emergency response mediation, or rest and digest, relaxation mediation. A recent piece of research, for instance, indicates that there's a hormone called osteocalcin is actually at least as responsible for the flight or fight response as adrenaline, which is produced in the musculoskeletal system. We're learning that things are much more diffuse, holistic, and whole body, mind body.
Mm-hmm. You said something interesting. You referred to its relationship to the feeling of safety, which to me seems very different than rest and digest. It's a much larger concept. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about the parasympathetic nervous system and its relationship to safety.
Yeah, I think it's vital. As far as I can see, and from my clinical experience as well, which was mostly around working with people with anxiety and trauma, being able to feel safe, which of course is a big part of the therapeutic relationship, a big part of what a good doctor does with their bedside manner is enabling somebody to feel safe and relaxed. If a person can't feel safe, then there's really nowhere for them to go. If we talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is interesting because actually Maslow never talked about the hierarchy of needs. But later on, this concept of the hierarchy of needs was attributed to him And certainly we can say that there are some needs which have to be met before higher functions can be met. I tend to think that feeling safe is ground zero, that all other needs are built on that. And I've been thinking a lot recently about the nature of trauma, which has been increasing recognition of, and the fact that you really wouldn't be able to find a population of people anywhere in the world who wouldn't have some element of trauma, who hasn't been the victim of slavery, Holocaust, colonization, invasion, war, famine. I mean, and the world made sense to me when I realized that pretty much everybody in the world has some type of trauma. And then if you look at the information that suggests that trauma is passed down through 7 generations, then I think you can sort of see the kind of critical mass that we're seeing now in the world.
So take us back then to how stimulating the vagus nerve, or perhaps toning the vagus nerve, is a way of making people feel safer in their bodies.
Thank you for distinguishing between toning and stimulating. I tend to reserve the use stimulation for electrical stimulation or some kind of physical manual stimulation, which with the nervous system tends to mean electrical. You can make a muscle or a nerve twitch by putting electrical impulses through it. On the other hand, a gentler, more holistic approach is to undertake practices which encourage a system to become stronger, to become more flexible, to become more resilient. Stephen Porges, originator of polyvagal theory, talks about vagal flexibility and vagal resilience. We can think of the vagus nerve as the anatomical manifestation of what we call the gut-brain superhighway, which is a fairly well-used term. So this literal pathway between the brain and the gut, we can think of as the vagus nerve. And we know that most of the things we feel are body feelings. We don't think we're in love. We feel in love, right? We don't think we're afraid. We feel afraid. And we have gut feelings, don't we? And something can feel like a kick in the gut or a twist in the gut. So we know that a lot of emotional feelings and responses are processed by the digestive system. And it's really the way that we feel about things, in my experience, that has a bigger impact on the decisions we make than how we think about things. Which is why, you know, no amount of data will sway somebody's decision. What will sway their decision is how they feel about it, which is why it's taken so long for most populations, for instance, to give up smoking. It's not about the data. Nobody can argue with the data about smoking. It's how it makes you feel when you smoke, which for a lot of people is a very relaxing sensation. So by mediating the internal and external world, by mediating how people feel, increasing the tone, the flexibility, the resiliency of the vagus nerves enables people to cope with higher levels of discomfort, higher levels of stress. The term I like to use these days is anti-fragility, not a term I invented by any means, but I think that's a good term because it's a uniquely biological concept. You know, we can build a mechanical device which is highly resilient, but you can only have a biological system which has anti-fragility, the idea being that it gets stronger with learning.
So how can we tone the vagus nerve? What are the methods available?
Yeah, so people have been toning their vagus nerve for the last few thousand years. This is where we see ceremony and ritual and practice, sacred practice particularly. You see common links here with modern practice. The use of voice and sound and chest. Yeah, so if you can make the chest resonate, given the location of the vagus nerve behind the sternum, as you say, it travels many places, but the primary location behind the sternum. So you can create resonance and humming and omming mantra-like sounds in the chest. You can stimulate the vagus nerve that way through vibration. And we know humming, we know gargling are stimulatory for the vagus nerve. With the technology I've developed, Sensate, we're essentially doing that. But rather than using your voice box to create the hum, to create the resonance, you're using a device that sits on the chest and uses bone conduction to stimulate the air in the thoracic cavity. Because there's a lot of space and there's a lot of air in the thorax. So it acts very much like the speaker in your hi-fi. So you could have a beautiful speaker, but if you stuck it in an old biscuit tin, it's not going to sound good. So the sensate's like the speaker, and your chest is the beautiful hi-fi. So all the air and the resonant capacity through bone conduction into the chest is where you feel the whole body vibration from.
When I was in medical school, I learned that putting your face in ice water stimulated the vagus nerve. I don't understand the mechanism behind that. And I also learned that you could just directly massage it. You could go next to your carotid artery and you could massage it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reptilian reflex, supposedly, that if you drop your face into cold water, it will produce a kind of startle response. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's a great thing. A lot of people are advocates for cold water exposure. Mm-hmm. Certainly that has biochemical effects on the white and the brown adipose tissue. And there's very good research for the longevity benefits of regular cold exposure, various explanations as for how that might be working. I think by increasing resiliency, you are working on vagal tone. I think resiliency and anti-fragility and vagal tone are almost different words for the same thing.
And what about breath control?
Well, absolutely. So, of course, breath is perhaps the only autonomic function that we can easily exert influence over. Unfortunately, usually that means we're exerting a negative influence. So people tend to hold their breath. I've never found somebody that forgets to breathe in, but I frequently meet people who forget to breathe out. It's very easy to hold one's breath and for that to become a habitual pattern, as you know very well. My experience of breath work, and as somebody who was taught to meditate at a very young age by my dad and who's studied breath work for 40 years or so, is that if somebody's autonomic flexibility isn't already there, then like meditation, it can quite easily have a negative impact. So one of the best ways to make somebody have a panic attack is to say to them, and now notice your breathing. Which for many people, they'll notice their breathing, right? And they'll realize they're not breathing that great. And then because they notice that, they'll start to hold their breath and then their CO2 will go down and they'll feel worse. One of the main reasons I developed the Sensate technology was I was finding that a large number of the people that came to see me that wanted and needed to relax actually felt worse when they tried to follow classical meditation or mindfulness meditation type techniques, which I think is not that surprising if you think about it. We live in a world where people are massively overstimulated. So to then ask somebody to sit down and notice themselves and to become aware of how they feel for 10 minutes can be quite challenging.
It is interesting that we're in this era where we're beginning to use devices to tone the nervous system as opposed to breathing, chanting, oming, other non-technological ways. And yet we are, and there's a very large body of evidence, starting with implanted vagus nerve stimulating for epilepsy and migraines, to now superficial, either right over the vagus nerve or, as Sensate is, over the chest, sometimes on the ear. And the research is really profound and very diverse. Headaches, Parkinson's, POTS, which is postural orthostatic hypotension, tachycardia syndrome. So it's fascinating that there's such a wide range of potential uses, not just for helping to reduce people's sense of anxiety, but in many other physical conditions.
Well, it does seem like a lot of the modern ailments that afflict us are to do with the autonomic nervous system.
Yeah, you know, a frequent diagnosis that I make, which is not official in the US, is autonomic dysfunction. And I will write that in my notes. I was very happy to see in Japan that is an official diagnosis. But it's obvious to me. I've also said that if I have 10 seconds with a patient to make a diagnosis, the best thing I can do is feel their hands. If people have cold hands in a warm room, that is to me a sign of an autonomic imbalance with overactive sympathetic activity, and they are in great need of vagal toning.
So, Andrew, what do you do? What's your approach when you find somebody who has this kind of issue?
Well, it depends on the person and my intuitive sense of what their makeup is. I might, if they're open to it, send them to a hypnotherapist. I might send them to a biofeedback practitioner. Mm-hmm. I might teach them my 4-7-8 breath, which is, a favorite breathing technique. I think it depends on the person and what they'll resonate with. I have had people, this is what similar to what you said, I've taught them that 4-7-8 breathing technique and they say they become more anxious when they do it. So that requires a different approach.
That's what I like about the use of something that has physical, mm-hmm. tactile capability. Having that physical embodiment of a feedback seems to be really important.
Yeah.
I've used a lot of biofeedback as well, and I think biofeedback's amazing, but it tends to be either auditory or visual,
yeah,
rather than physical. Yeah. And again, just what I found really over decades in the clinic was that without that embodiment, you're going to get a percentage of people who disassociate.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can see, the percentage has got higher and higher over the last decade or two.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one thing I have found in recommending Sensei to a number of people and using it myself is that in some ways it requires that you lay still for 10 minutes. In fact, I listened to a person compare Sensei with Apollo Neuro, which is another vagal nerve toning device. You wear it usually on your ankle, but you don't have to stop. You can just wear it with whatever activity you're doing. And the person was saying how wonderful it was. You never had to stop. And I'm thinking, therein lies the problem.
It's like the ubiquitous comment from the meditation teacher when you say, but I can't find 10 minutes to meditate. And they go, well, then you need to spend an hour.
Yeah.
We have been criticized by some people saying that, well, the only reason people that use Sensei feel better is because they're lying down and not doing anything for 10 minutes. Which feels a little bit like doctors saying the only reason holistic patients get better is because we're nice to them. It always seemed like a strange criticism to me. We've done enough research now to know that there are biological and biochemical effects. And actually, a lot, what we see a lot is a neural synchronization in the brain. We've seen that across a couple of studies now, which is very interesting because that's essentially what you get in meditation. You get kind of neural synchronization. So it's interesting. That's what we're seeing with people, even though we're not targeting the brain. In fact, we're trying to not target the brain because I think the brain is really complex and nobody really understands what's going on up there. But by working on the chest, the heart, the thymus, and the body, it's obviously sending some kind of positive signals to the brain that everything's okay and you can kind of harmonize and it's all good.
You mentioned Stephen Porges earlier, and one of the things that I understand about his polyvagal theory is that he really points to this third part of the vagus nerve that's responsible for social engagement, which of course is something we tend to do when we feel safer. What I haven't seen him do is link that to the work that Shelley Taylor at UCLA did, the tendon befriend. That's this other part of how we as a species have managed our anxiety or our reaction to stress. So to me, that whole piece of when you're super stressed, you can't engage with others.
I think that's, and tender befriend, and there are a number of other ideas and concepts which have been brought in. So fawn and freak, and I forget some of the others, in addition to flight, fight, and freeze. There seems to be some unwritten rule that it has to begin with F. I think we're gonna run. Well, there's a few more we could think of, but I think we're gonna run out of X as well. Then,
can you summarize polyvagal theory for us?
Oh my word! I'll say what I think it means. Yeah. Stephen can tell me I'm wrong later. I mean, so what I think the beauty of polyvagal theory for me is that it's created a recognition. Certainly amongst clinicians or trauma-based clinicians in particular, that we have a body as well as a mind. Yeah. And that we're not brains in a jar and that we can't be treated like brains in a jar. I don't mean we won't be treated like brains in a jar. I mean, if you actually want to have a clinically positive outcome, you have to recognize that we have minds and bodies at the very least. Mm-hmm. And that over the last few hundred million years of evolution, or however you want to view that, we've got to where we are now. Connection, as you say, Victoria, is a major element within the way in which we've learned to self-soothe and self-pacify and to feel safe. We've developed and grown up in communities. We have connection with animals and with nature, or we did until fairly recently, and that's part of the problem, right? We know that connection with nature is quite possibly the most powerful healer anyone can offer or have. So, and I think sound is the great unifier here. Yeah, we've become very reliant on visual sensory data. But I think sound is something that we all experience in a profoundly different way in time and space to visual information. Sound in particular is not so brain orientated. And my hypothesis is that we only hear about 50% of sound. That the other 50% is experienced via vibration and other receptors in the body, some of which haven't yet necessarily been classified as such, but that I'm quite confident that the discovery of fascia, of connective tissue, as a sensory organ, essentially water in a fluid gel-like matrix. And anyone who's been up a mountain and dropped pebbles into a pond knows what happens when you stimulate water. Increasingly in anthropology, there's an idea that language came from song, not the other way around. Having the ability to speak complex language because we sung to each other.
Ah.
And human language is very complex. It's unique. Only birds can produce complex sounds in the way that we can. What I love about sound also is how it confounds Darwinism. Because there are so many elements to sound and to music and to dance, which don't necessarily provide a classical Darwinistic survival advantage.
Mm.
But yet we do them. And in many ways, those are the things which make us uniquely human.
Mm-hmm.
Andy, I imagine in your travels around the world, you witness the use of sound and vibration in many cultures. I'm wondering if you...
Well, I'll tell you...
Mindless conversation, yeah.
Yeah, I'll just tell you one story. Some years ago, I was at the Field Museum in Chicago, and it was a founders' night where their big donors had come, and there were various presentations. And one of them, they had a very large, I think it was antique gamelan ensemble, a collection of Indonesian gongs and drums, and they got players to play these vast instruments. And it was in a big hall, which had great acoustics. And one of the pieces they played was a war chant that was designed to prepare people for battle. Somewhere in the middle of that, I could just feel this in my body. I wanted to smash things. Huh? I wanted to just run out and smash things. It was a very powerful experience of seeing how sound could really control my emotions and, in a sense, my body.
I'll give a little testimonial. I've known you, Andy, for 26 years, and I've never known you to want to smash things.
Never played the right music.
I guess not. And I'm not going to either.
Okay. Hey, let's not go to war.
I wonder when I'm driving around and a car pulls up next to me with a boombox going at top volume. And what is the effect of that on the nervous system of the person in the car and the people around it? And I think people are very unconscious of the sounds that they expose themselves to.
And the reverse of that, of course, is when a mother sings a lullaby to her baby.
Yeah. And of course, a human experience, our first experience of sound is via bone conduction, water transmission in utero.
Yep. Yep.
As you say, the first sounds a baby hears are its mother through bone and through fluid.
Mm-hmm.
So our neural pathways develop to hear that and to expect that. And I think that's why sound is very different from electrical stimulation, even microcurrent electrical stimulation. So I am also in awe, as are you, Victoria, of the medical applications for vagus nerve stimulation, the implantables and the subcutaneous devices. I think that's brilliant, but it's a specific field of medicine and it's not what we're doing. Using acoustic stimulation to enable the autonomic nervous system and the chest and the thymus and the heart and the lungs and the diaphragm to go into a kind of harmonic rhythm which then creates a mind-body connection, is a very different experience. And I think there is a move towards this. There's a move towards back to nature. There's a move towards people being interested in ritualistic, shamanistic, more ancient knowledge. But there's also a need, it seems, to provide this in a kind of easily assimilatable format for people in the short term as well. So my hope is that we're on like 60 million minutes or something like that. A lot of minutes have been spent on Sensate. The kind of testimonials we get make me cry on a regular basis. People whose lives have been changed. Every day we get kind of spontaneous descriptions from people who were suicidal, who were victims of trauma in various shapes or forms, and who absolutely say that their experience of Sensate has changed their lives, which is a beautiful, a wonderful thing and a great honor to be part of. But we know that people are so overstimulated. Yeah. And so many people are on the edge of disassociation that asking them in many cases to go off and do a 10-day Vipassana retreat or a 10-minute meditation exercise is not going to do the job. Mm-hmm. So what do we do? This is the crisis that I found, right? So what do we do with those people? Do we say, well, not my problem. I can't help these people. The techniques I've been trained in don't work for them, but they work for these people, and I'm going to work with these people. And my experience is the people that can meditate, people that are able to self-regulate, are the ones that we don't need to help. They're going to find a way one way or another. It's the people that need the help that I want to reach out to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Stefan, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for the deep caring you have for all the folks who are struggling out there and for this wonderful device that you've created. We appreciate talking with you about it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here. It's always fantastic to talk about the work we do, which is a great honor to be part of.